From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, this August is expected to be Boston's hottest on record.
Our winters are much longer, so we appreciate the hot weather. Check in on our elderly, and all is well.
But climate projections indicate we should gear up for even hotter summers. Will Boston be able to adapt? And Cambridge-based Biogen releases promising new results on a drug hoping to slow the effects of Alzheimer's. Also today,
when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
That's 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick on his decision to sit during the national anthem. We'll get Bill Littlefield's take on the controversy. Plus, we'll check in with Sheila Dillon, Boston's chief of neighborhood development on housing in the city. That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, here we are, the end of the month, and it's expected that this will have been the hottest August ever recorded in Boston. And if long-term climate projections hold, we're going to have to get used to more sweltering heat. Back in May, the city initiative Climate Ready Boston found that by 2030, there may be as many as 40 days of 90-plus degree weather around here. And by 2070, there could be as many as 90 days over 90 degrees. So basically, the whole summer. Well, how will Boston adapt to a climate that could look less like New England and more like, I don't know, Baltimore or Atlanta? Well, for more, we're joined by Dennis Carlberg. He's Director of Sustainability at Boston University, and he's also co-chair of the Sustainability Council at the Urban Land Institute. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks a lot, Meghna.
You know, last time we had you on because there's been a lot of attention focused on sea level rise when it comes to climate change. And of course, that's a major issue around here as well. But you had hinted back then that really we ought to be thinking about the effects of heat because we're going to feel the effects of that much sooner than we'll feel the effects of rising sea level. It seems that your prognosis is being borne out right before our very eyes.
Well, it's not my prognosis. It's the scientist's prognosis, and it's pretty clear that we're experiencing this, and it will definitely be continuing. And as you pointed out at the beginning, the projections from the Climate Ready Boston report look to be like we're going to need to prepare carefully about rising temperatures, and we need to do that sooner, because that's going to be affecting us sooner, and it's going to be affecting our neighborhoods and underserved populations and vulnerable populations. That's the bigger issue.
Right. So what are the, I mean, walk us through what some of the immediate effects of, you know, month after month of high temperatures would be or will be.
Well, I think NASA's just reported that we've had the 10 hottest months consecutively on record, and if August follows that pattern, it will be 11 months mm-hmm. in a row. July was the hottest record
ever recorded.
So this is an issue we need to be addressing, and we're going to need to address it more quickly. Solutions, you know, obviously cooling areas are things that we use today, mm-hmm. And the city has been proactive in really exploring solutions. And I think the Climate Ready Boston report and the vulnerability assessment that is going to be released shortly will help define those solutions.
Yeah, you know, so I think to myself, there are a lot of parts of the world that live with these kind of temperatures all the time. And so it's not as if it's impossible to live with 90-plus degree days frequently. But I think the key thing here is that it's not normal for us here in this region,
well,
right?
It's not normal. Our buildings are not built to support yeah. those temperatures. You know, throughout history and the development of Boston and all of our communities, we've had what we thought was a normal temperatures,
yeah.
and we're getting out of normal. And, you know, so better insulation will be huge, but air conditioning is going to have to be ramped up
I mean, what do you think Boston's particular vulnerabilities are then?
Well, I think, again, in the neighborhoods where people don't have the ability to go out and buy air conditioning systems and in many cases don't have the ability to be putting in insulation, you know, those are challenges. I think one easy solution for people, most of the building stock in Boston, the older building stock, has double-hung windows. Mm-hmm. Most people open the bottom sash. If you open the top sash, you get better ventilation.
Right.
You get better cooling. So it's pointing things like that out to our members of our community that will help in the shorter term.
Well, what about sort of larger scale means to make the city and the urban area more heat resilient?
Oh.
I mean, we've talked frequently about, you know, we need more greenery, essentially.
Absolutely.
More trees, more shade, more rooftop gardens.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, that's really what you're getting to is the urban heat island effect.
Yeah.
Our urban development is, you know, 5 to 15 degrees warmer than rural areas around it. And that's because of all the hard surfaces that absorb the sun's energy and then re-radiate that. So the ambient temperature is much higher. I think, you know, more open space, more parkland, less hard surfaces is really important. And where you have hard surfaces, if they can be lighter, more reflective surfaces so they don't absorb that heat, these are strategies we know work.
I mean, do you think Boston's on track to create the kind of green spaces or heat-absorbent infrastructure that we need?
I think we're working on it, but I think a lot more emphasis needs to be put on it. And I think, you know, through the Climate Ready Boston efforts, that is getting a finer focus.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we're focusing on sort of the urban effects of rising temperatures in this conversation. But I do want to, of course, acknowledge that there are effects on agriculture.
Absolutely.
On forests, on natural systems as well across the region. I mean, each of them deserve their own conversation, truthfully. But regarding sort of an urban area's ability to cope with more consistent higher temperatures, you know, I was looking at a report from the United Nations that was looking globally, and it said that cities cover less than 2% of the Earth's surface, but they produce more than 60% of all carbon dioxide. So I'm wondering if that's part of the long-term coping mechanism here, is that this is one way in which we can, like, really look locally and to also have a local effect in terms of reducing carbon emissions?
It's actually an interesting point. We have faculty here at Boston University that are looking at absorbing carbon with urban trees. Urban trees seem to be very effective in absorbing carbon emissions. And of course, we do have more carbon emissions in cities. We have more people.
Right.
I think there are solutions that have multiple benefits.
Yeah.
And I think those are really what we need to be looking for.
Interesting. You know, we also must acknowledge that we're in the middle of a drought as well, with all this heat. But the two aren't necessarily completely linked, right? Because I was looking at there's some other research that says that one of the concerns that some folks have with longer and hotter periods that we will probably be experiencing is that we actually might ironically have more rainfall, possibly, and that's a concern?
You know, I think what we're up against is a very different climate. It's going to be different than we've ever experienced. And I think we need to be resilient as individuals. We need to be resilient in our communities. You know, we don't really have all the answers, but certainly there is a possibility that we may have more, frankly, it'll probably be more intense rain for shorter periods of time, which doesn't solve the drought problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
It creates flooding problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are really where the worries are. Mm-hmm. More intense storms, and you've got warmer temperatures in the oceans, which, you know, we've seen it time and time again, where you get more moisture in the clouds and then you get much heavier downpours and more bursts of rain.
Mm-hmm.
And those are issues that we really can't cope with right now.
Right.
We don't have the capacity. Our infrastructure is not there.
Well, are there examples that you can think of in other cities that are also dealing with the hotter future that we all seem to be facing, and maybe innovative ideas from there that could be useful for Boston to consider?
Frankly, I've been looking more at the water, rising water issues relative to what other cities are doing. And, you know, we look to Europe a lot for that.
Right.
There's a great partnership between the city and the Netherlands to learn lessons there.
Okay. Well, Dennis Carlberg is Director of Sustainability at Boston University. He also helped compile the Urban Land Institute's 2014 report about preparing Boston for climate change. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Fans of Willy Wonka, Jim the Waco Kid, and Young Frankenstein continue to mourn the death of actor Gene Wilder. He died Sunday from complications of Alzheimer's disease at the age of 83. Now, Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death among U.S. adults, and 5 million Americans are affected by the disease. But today, there's encouraging news from Cambridge-based Biogen. The biotech company published the results from a clinical trial of a drug that could slow down the disease's progress. Well, joining us now with more on this is Dr. Dennis Selko, co-director of the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Disease at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Selko, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
It's great to have you. Well, first of all, just for full disclosure and clarity's sake, are you directly associated with this study that Biogen has published?
No, I am not, and I don't have any special relationship with Biogen.
Okay, good. We wanted to get that formality out of the way here. So explain to us, the drug that Biogen tested is aducanumab, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. What specifically is it said to have accomplished in this clinical trial?
Well, it accomplished something quite remarkable. It was able, in just a 12-month period, to lower the level of the notorious amyloid plaques in the brains of patients with typical Alzheimer's disease. And that lowering of the plaque burden correlated exactly with the dose of the antibody that was given. And what's most important is that that was associated with a lessening of cognitive decline. So it was not that the antibody cured the disease at this juncture or completely took away the symptoms, but it seemed to arrest it, particularly at the highest dose they used.
Oh, wow. So it was very strongly correlated, as you say, with the amount that was given to the patients?
Exactly. So the dose really mattered. So the amount that was given to the patient, and this is given intravenously through an infusion that is painless and easy to do in a doctor's office or hospital setting. That infusion occurs once a month, and they tried placebo, and they tried four other doses of the antibody. And the more antibody they administered each month, the lower the amyloid plaque burden in the patient's brain went. And at the highest dose, they got to a much lower plaque burden, just a little bit above what one needed to qualify for the trial in the first place.
Right. Well, Dr. Selko, remind us briefly, these amyloid plaques, remind us how they're thought to be the primary cause or affect memory loss in Alzheimer's patients.
Well, there's a great deal of genetic and neuropathologic evidence that, number one, everybody with Alzheimer's has these plaques. It's a defining feature of the disease. Number two, they begin perhaps 20 or more years before someone forgets where they parked their car or the name of their eighth grandchild or something important like that. Long before that, these amyloid plaques are building up. Well, how would we know that? Because there are terrific ways to image the amyloid plaques in patients harmlessly by doing a special kind of PET scan. And that was done in all of the 165 individuals in this study from Biogen. So one knew for sure that they had mild symptoms of Alzheimer's and they had plaque buildup. And the antibody was given all the time. And the best evidence that the plaque buildup matters to the cognitive impairment is that genetically, people who have accelerated plaque buildup for a variety of reasons are much more likely to get clinical Alzheimer's and have more memory trouble.
Right. Well, to be clear, though, nobody who participated in this trial, no one's saying that anyone was cured of their Alzheimer's or that even there was a substantial reversal in impairment.
That's exactly right. And that's very important for your listeners to understand that this was something that at the highest dose that was tested in this admittedly small study, there was an apparent arrest or plateau of decline. And that's great news because we simply don't see that otherwise. This disease doesn't have a mechanism for arresting it. But it isn't a cure and it isn't a reversal of the disease.
Mm. Well, nevertheless, if the results of this study are replicated and confirmed, I am seeing, people in the Alzheimer's research community saying that this could be a game changer. Do you agree with that?
I very much do. The data are really beautiful. As a scientist and physician, if I look at the data in detail, they're very compelling, very convincing. And so this is what we've been waiting for. Now, it is true that it's still an experimental drug or an experimental antibody, and it is currently in phase 3, and people can actually seek to enroll in the phase 3 studies that Biogen is conducting around the world in many, many centers. So until that phase 3 final testing is done, we can't be super enthusiastic, but all of the data in this new paper are consistent with the idea that the amyloid buildup is what's triggering the progressive memory failure. And if you could arrest the amyloid buildup, that would be good news for your memory.
Mm-hmm. But to sort of exercise a healthy dose of caution here, there have been potential therapies in the past or drug treatments in the past that seemed very promising in the early clinical trials, but then later went on to fail their clinical trials and even, if I remember the literature correctly, caused the death of some patients who were participating in those trials. Is that not true?
So the last point is not the case. They didn't actually cause the death of people.
Okay.
There was no evidence of that. But there were very early attempts at lowering amyloid that led to allergic reactions in some patients, and trials had to be terminated. Other trials didn't even have that. They went all the way through to 18 months of trying the drug, but the results were very weak. This study is different, I think, because the data are so clear that in just 6 months, amyloid lowering had already begun, and by 12 months, there was considerably more amyloid lowering in the brain, and that was associated with a benefit on a classical cognitive test that we use in people with Alzheimer's. No other trial heretofore achieved that level of rigor, that level of scientific proof. So you're right, we've had failures, but generally they have not looked near as good as these data do. Having said that, we still need the results of the phase 3 trial to be certain that when extended to much larger number of patients, these data hold up.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Selko, while we have you, I'd love to sort of get your bigger picture view on where we are in terms of research and development for any sort of therapy for Alzheimer's. I mean, it seems as if this focus on the amyloid plaques is bearing fruit. Is that where you'd like to see the research continue?
I think we need a lot of research on a number of different abnormalities in the Alzheimer's brain. And these plaques are one of the main abnormalities. We also have tangles in the brain, and we've known about those for more than 100 years since Alzheimer described the disease. We need approaches to lower the tangles. There's a mild type of inflammation going on in the Alzheimer patient's brain, and we need to tune down that inflammatory process, and there are experimental drugs now that seem to be able to do that, although they're nowhere near as advanced as the article we're talking about today. So we need multiple shots on goal, not just amyloid-oriented, but the amyloid has been so strongly validated by Alzheimer genetics and by mouse models, etc., that this article is going the right direction, and we need more competing antibodies like this to lower amyloid levels. And not just antibodies, but even pills. There are trials underway that are in phase 3 of an oral pill, mm-hmm. more than one, that could also lower amyloid levels in the brain.
Yeah. You know, at the start of our conversation, I noted the fact that Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. amongst adults. But then we noted that the rate of Alzheimer's, there were a couple of studies from 2014 and this year that seem to say that the rate of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias may be falling in the U.S. and other developed countries. Is that true?
There is some evidence for that. It's still somewhat debatable. But the reason that might be happening is because people are now much more cognizant of doing the best they can for their brain health. So going on the so-called Mediterranean diet, getting proper exercise, taking care of any other medical problem that could affect your brain, obviously avoiding strokes, avoiding head trauma, wearing helmets when you bicycle ride, all of those kinds of things seem to be leading to a relatively subtle downturn of the growth of the Alzheimer's problem. But don't tell that to someone who's just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's mm-hmm. and who is really having trouble forgetting important things in her life, like the names of her grandchildren. So we see a huge amount of Alzheimer's, and we're not about to not see it. It's good, though, that good brain health might be taking the edge off the rate of rise in Alzheimer's.
Yeah. I appreciate that you said her there because almost, what is it, two-thirds of the more than 5 million Americans who have Alzheimer's are women. Do we have a better understanding as to why that is?
It's not quite as high as that. It may be more like 55-45 or 60-40, not quite two-thirds, but it's overrepresented in women, even taking into account their greater longevity in our society. And we are working hard to figure out what is it. Is it a hormonal influence? Is it something about brain chemistry that's slightly different? And the answer is not in. But we do know that women have more than their fair share of a burden from Alzheimer's, and we're cognizant of that. And, of course, in this trial, gender made no difference. People were helped whether they were male or female in the trial.
Yeah. Dr. Selko, I'm curious. I mean, there's been a lot of attention, for example, on Vice President Joe Biden's call for a cancer moonshot, right, to find a cure for cancer. When it comes to Alzheimer's, for example, Hillary Clinton's presidential health platform includes a proposal to spend $2 billion annually on Alzheimer's research at the NIH. What are your thoughts on what's needed or what could further the development of new treatments for Alzheimer's?
Well, I'd answer that question from the perspective of my patients, and that is they are so sad and so upset when they learn that they have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's and they know what lies ahead that our society does need to pull out the stops. This is a very common disease. The number of people is increasing who get it because the disease lasts long and people do survive for years with the disease. I would say that a moonshot or a much more robust public response to trying to solve Alzheimer's is necessary, and all of this good work, well, this study happens to be done by a company. It's all based on academic research initially that was done with taxpayer dollars, NIH-funded research. So I applaud the idea of a dramatic increase in spending for Alzheimer's. Some of that has happened now in the Obama administration, and we need to look to the next president getting behind a real increase in research spending because, frankly, without basic research that's expensive and takes a long time, you won't find the drug that actually cures your Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Selko, you've been one of the leading researchers on Alzheimer's since the 1980s, right? Mm-hmm. What keeps you going?
Well, I feel tremendous passion about not telling another patient, another family, gee, you seem to have Alzheimer's and there isn't any definitive treatment out there. We can help you a bit. We can make you feel better. We can plan for your future. We can give you some symptomatic medicines that might take the edge off of your confusion for a little while. but I don't want to tell people anymore that there is little or nothing we can really do definitively, and I want to be able to write a prescription for my patients that comes from a drug or an antibody, in this case, that my research and other people's research had something to do with, and I'm getting that feeling now. This study makes me quite excited, and in terms of why I continue to be passionate about this, if you sit with families who suffer from Alzheimer's, and you mentioned Gene Wilder as an example earlier, and he's a remarkable actor that entertained all of us lifelong. You don't want to see people suffer this just at the time when they've completed many of life's tasks and they're looking forward to some time off and some positivity, and then they're faced with this terrible diagnosis. That is more than enough stimulus to keep me going.
Well, Dr. Dennis Selko, he's the co-director of the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Disease at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Time now for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. Today, writer Alyssa Eli remembers how a North Andover man tried to always be there for his family.
The best way to get Joe Rajewski Jr.'s help, whether it was on a house repair or a 66 Mustang restoration, was to start the project yourself and then, in Joe's presence, realize your hopeless inadequacy. He could make or fix anything. He lived on a higher plane of technical competence, some kind of mechanical Olympus, but he descended whenever the people he loved needed him. It wasn't just plumbing or electrical work. Less practical wishes got the same kind of scrutiny. When his daughter, Genevieve Rajewski, wanted a Ghostbusters costume, he created one with a working proton pack. When she decided she loved miniature mechanical horse competitions, he created a one-man toy horse body shop.
And then he just sort of set up this shop. He would use a blowtorch, so he would saw off their legs, and then he would like melt the plastic with a blowtorch from either his plumbing tools or his mechanical tools and put them back together. He just would do it.
When Genevieve's brother took up bonsai cultivation, he and Joe trained saplings into painstaking scenes. Almost as an afterthought, Joe also created a bonsai garden in the backyard. Then the kids went through a karate phase. Joe took on the entire dojo, ripped up the school's carpet, painted the walls with inspirational messages, and incidentally, learned to perfect a full split. A million helpful projects were always underway, and yet when his wife worked in a home for troubled teens, there was time for him to surprise everyone with ice cream and Sunday fixings. And when Genevieve had a newborn on her sleepless hands, he drove 40 minutes with a cup of coffee. These were declarations of love, practical and unsentimental.
Even when you'd have him over for dinner, he'd be bussing your table and putting everything in the dishwasher and unloading your dishwasher. Like, yeah, I think he had a small problem with staying still.
Joe had a hard time asking for help when he was ill. First with colon cancer and then with bladder cancer. In a world where it's all about me, it was never about him.
He just was worried. Like, he felt like he had so much stuff left to do, and he was frustrated by that, and, you know, that he really didn't care about himself. It was just more like, I'm the guy that takes care of things, who is going to take care of stuff when I'm not here.
No one took care of stuff like Joe did. But in his absence and in his honor, everyone is trying.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Joe Rajewski, who died in March at the age of 68. To suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. Well, it's time now for our weekly check-in in the world of sports with NPR, the host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Magna.
Let's get right down to business and talk about that controversy with San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick when he refused to stand for the national anthem during a preseason game last Friday. He explained afterwards that he was protesting police brutality.
There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. That's not right by anyone's standards.
He's getting a lot of pushback for what he did, though. Bill, your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting, Meghna. He is getting some pushback, and some officials, particularly associated with the police, have said, you know, they're not particularly appreciative of that that sentiment. He's also getting a lot of support. His teammates, some coaches, and lots of different people have supported him for standing up for something that he believes and for, more specifically, making such a public stand that it has generated a response.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing that on the one hand, as you noted, San Francisco Police, the San Francisco Police Union, or a San Francisco Police Union, has demanded that the NFL denounce Kaepernick. But on the other hand, there's this trending hashtag, Veterans for Kaepernick, that show U.S. members of the U.S. military showing their support of his right to protest, whether or not they agree what he was protesting about. You know, I have to say, we were looking at an article on from the Bleacher Report, Mike Freeman, who wrote that he had talked to seven members of various front offices at the NFL, and most of those front office folks said that they think Kaepernick could be or would be or will be released by the 49ers and never play in the NFL again.
Yeah, there was some speculation that he would be released simply because he's not the best quarterback that they could put on the field, which is the reason teams generally release players. I don't know how much this would have to do with it. I'm sure that if he were released, there would be people who would say that that was the reason for his release. But I think there's a much larger issue here, and I think Kaepernick would agree. He's not the story. The story really is that somebody has stood up and said, hey, we should be paying attention to the fact that we live in a culture that is institutionally segregated and discriminatory. We live in a culture that tolerates all manner of injustice, racial injustice and other sorts of injustice. And why should somebody who feels strongly about that stand and honor the flag that stands, in his mind at least, for that culture? Why not say, I will stand for that flag when this country becomes as great as it can possibly be, not in Donald Trump's terms, but in terms of actually accomplishing something for its poorest and most disadvantaged citizens? This, to me, is a very patriotic stand. And the way you define patriotism, I suppose, depends on where you come from. Yeah. But to me, this is an admirable move.
You know, your point is very well taken, Bill. But I am curious about why does it seem that when a black athlete chooses to take a public stand like that on the field of play, there does seem to be more... The storm of controversy seems to swirl ever more vigorously around that, around black athletes.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's why it took significant courage for Colin Kaepernick to do what he did. I think what you've just said simply demonstrates the fact that we live in a culture that's not entirely fair and equitable and just.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about how to make the transition now to another football story, which, given all that we talked about regarding justice and taking a stand, this seems like so much smaller potatoes. Yeah, but
story about two white quarterbacks.
Yes. The Patriots, they close out their preseason this Thursday against the Giants, and they'll be playing their first four games of the regular season without Tom Brady. He's going to be serving his Deflategate suspension. But quickly, Bill, how did backup QB Jimmy Garoppolo do?
Well, I kind of feel like I don't want to dignify that question with an answer because, of course you do, and I understand your job requires you to ask the question. We're talking about preseason football games. This is the greatest ripoff in the NFL, which is so full of ripoffs, where they force you to buy tickets to preseason games if you buy a season ticket. Nobody wants to see these preseason games. I mean, even if Tom Brady weren't suspended because of Deflategate, he wouldn't be playing all that much in a preseason game. He'd be playing part of it and then sitting down and resting so he'd be ready for the regular season. And yet, yes, people are, of course, drawing conclusions about his backup's play at quarterback. It doesn't mean anything. This guy could throw 11 touchdowns four straight weeks and Tom Brady would still be the starting quarterback in game five.
Okay. Well, let's just squeeze in one last thing here because I do want to ask you about that. Only a Game has some coverage planned coming up this weekend, I think, of Rio and the Paralympics in the coming weeks and also Rio the City post the Olympic Games. Can you just tell us briefly about that?
Well, I can tell you what our ambition is as far as Rio, coverage of Rio going forward. We did a rather ambitious piece about people who had been dispossessed in one of the favelas in Rio in preparation for the Olympics. They had their homes torn down and wrecked. They mm-hmm. were all moved unceremoniously into all sorts of other places, which were much less convenient to the work they were trying to do and that sort of thing. And we're going to follow up on that. Months down the line, we're going to see what happens to that land that yeah. was basically home to thousands of people. And we're going to see what developers got it and what sort of housing replaces the housing that basically workers were occupying.
Well, looking forward to that reporting as it develops, but we also have the show coming up this weekend, which you can hear on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., and your guide will be Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks so much.
Thanks for the opportunity, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Sheila Dillon joins us now. She's Chief of Housing and Director of Boston's Department of Neighborhood Development. And our annual Great Migration, the September move-in, is underway, so we thought it would be a good time to check in with her on all aspects of housing in Boston. Sheila Dillon, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back. And listeners, if you've got a question for Sheila Dillon about housing in Boston, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Sheila, there's a ton to talk with you about, but I do have to just acknowledge that thousands and thousands of people are moving things in and out of apartments today and tomorrow. So what's your message to the city's newest or returning residents, all those students?
Well, I think first and foremost, if you're living off campus and in a neighborhood, be well behaved and respectful of your neighbors. But more seriously, if you're having any kind of issue, call the city's 311 line and we will get you help. If you move in and your condition of your apartment isn't, you know, what it should be, call 311. If your landlord's not, you know, forthcoming on leases and information, call 311. We are really, you know, beefing up staff to make sure that everybody gets moved in safely.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the number of students living off campus, I know the mayor has actually aimed to have more students live on campus and have the city work with, you know, the many colleges and universities around here. And he wanted to hit some 16,000 new dormitory beds in the city by 2030. Lots of construction going on this front on various campuses. But I'm wondering how you feel, how far along the city is getting or has come towards reaching the mayor's goal.
Sure. Well, we're real pleased. You know, we're 2 years into the mayor's housing plan, and you're right. You read the plan. We wanted to create an additional 16,000 additional beds for undergrad students. And to date, we've pulled permits for about 3,000 dorm beds, which is terrific, and we have another 1,000, 1,500 in the pipeline. So we're very, very pleased with that progress. And the mayor has had great meetings with the colleges and universities presidents. He's told them how serious he is about this, and they are really, really trying very, very hard to accommodate. You know, we had about 148,000 students, graduate and undergraduate, that come to Boston every year to study, which is great for the economy and great for Boston. But about 35,000 of those students live in our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. 20,000 of those are undergrad. We would love to see that number reduced because we have such demand for our housing.
Okay, so let's talk about that demand for amongst the city's residents, because it was back in May that the office of your office launched a new program that was designed or is designed to try to protect affordable housing units, affordable apartments, from being purchased and then converted into luxury units by big developers. So earlier this month, the first property was sold under that program in Roslindale, right?
That is correct. So we're doing everything we can. You know, Boston, the population's growing. It's a very desirable place to be, and there's a lot of pressure right now on our housing stock. So we're trying to meet the demand by building a lot of additional housing for all folks, elderly, low-income, middle-income. Even luxury housing is taking some pressure off the market. But we were also noticing, like you said, that some investors, developers, were buying smaller properties, most of them, 6 units, 12 units, 20 units, and either clearing out the buildings or raising rents on the existing tenants. So we, you know, met with a lot of our partners and came up with a new program, the Acquisition Opportunity Program, where nonprofits and for-profits can get some money from the city and working with their banks can go out and acquire these properties.
They get $75,000 per unit.
That's right, of city money. The hitch is that they've got to keep the existing tenants, and they have to then deed restrict the units that they're getting funding for. Mm. And, you know, it is a difficult thing because, you know, you're competing with cash buyers. You're buying occupied buildings. They're very desirable and prices are high. But we were very pleased to see Roslindale close on the first building. And we have two nonprofits in East Boston that have lines of credit that are out there shopping.
Yeah.
So we're hoping the program grows.
So this is interesting because I was wondering if you might share with us some lessons that you learned, because you just identified some of the major challenges, right, that these programs face. First of all, that $75,000 per unit, while without a doubt helpful, I mean, it just doesn't go all that far. As you said, the market is supporting prices that are like, what, four times the amount for those units?
Well, you have to support some debt here on these properties too. So the 75 is making it possible for the lower rents to work. But it's not going to work in every neighborhood. So we're hoping in neighborhoods like Roslindale, like East Boston, like Roxbury, like parts of Dorchester, the prices are still low enough that this economics can work.
Yeah. Well, and also then there's sort of the deeper structural challenges, right? Because the not-for-profit groups who are participating with the city in this program and the city itself maybe can't be as nimble or fast-acting as those cash buyers you were talking about. And in this, you know, superheated housing market, sellers are looking for buyers who can, you know, close as fast as possible with as much cash as possible. So is there anything that the program could do to help speed the process?
Right. Well, we're working with CDAC, and we're working with other funders, and we're getting them to close within 30 days. So we're trying to be, maybe we can never be as nimble as a cash buyer, but we're trying to say to any seller, we'll pay you fair market price, and we'll close within 30 days, and you have our guarantees. So it's better than it has been, and I think the nonprofits are learning how to be nimble and learning that they must be nimble if they want to compete.
Well, so the city is guaranteeing a 30-day close?
Well, and with the entity that's giving most of the financing. And in this case, it was CDAC, which is a great quasi-public funder. And so they're getting they're looking at a quick appraisal, which is being done in a matter of a week. They're talking to their board, and they're willing to close within 30 days.
Wow.
So it is a little out of character for all of us, but we're really trying to compete.
Well, you know, I mean, the housing market being what it is, I think requires out-of-character solutions.
Absolutely. I'm shocked at how many investors are walking around that are able to pay cash for buildings. And so we need to keep pace.
And vast sums of cash. Now this Roslindale purchase was 8 units, and the program would be able to fund a total of 100 units throughout the city?
Right. Well, we thought we would put, you know, we put $7.5 million up, and we're hoping to do 100 units. And if it's successful, we will do more. And this is in addition to funding, you know, more traditional affordable housing development, which we've also seen increases in. And we're putting a lot of money on the street. And we're working with the private developers and extracting a lot of affordable units from the private market right now, too. So it's every tool we have we're putting towards this issue.
Mm. Let's take a quick call. Bob is calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Bob.
Hi, thanks. I have a question. I'm realizing that affordable housing has been such a need and been so talked about lately, especially I heard there was the protest this morning in Cambridge around the need for affordable housing. And I'm just wondering, in the future, in the mayor's plan, in terms of affordable housing and even safe affordable housing for other at-risk populations like seniors, and specifically safe affordable housing for LGBT elders, is there anything that's in the plan that's going to address these groups?
So that's a great question, and you know, the senior population in Boston is our fastest growing demographic. So we are desperately trying to build senior affordable housing because it is a great, great need. And we have a pretty healthy pipeline right now of affordable senior housing. We're also working very hard for seniors that want to stay in their homes. We are working very, very closely with our homeowner office, and we're doing roofs and windows and grab bars and making sure that seniors can stay in their homes for as long as they like. We are working with a developer out of Pennsylvania right now who's interested in developing senior housing that is LGBT friendly. Fair housing doesn't allow us to set aside units, but that to build housing that is more sensitive. So we're looking at a site right now. I don't want to disclose the location, but we are looking at a site for this particular type of housing.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Sheila Dillon, you know, I want to ask you a couple questions about the types of housing that need to be built in Boston. Because, you know, you've been on the show in the past and we've talked about the only long-term solution to the housing crunch here is we got to build our way out of it, right? And so I'm sure you saw the article in the Globe a little earlier this week about luxury housing and foreign investors buying a lot of the luxury stocks, for example, in the Millennium Tower. I'm just wondering what your take is on that. One developer, for example, said that Boston right now has, in his words, phenomenal fundamentals when it comes to global money pouring in to housing and real estate here.
So we need to build housing for all populations, all walks of life. I mean, that's clear. Every single demographic needs additional housing. But what we don't want to see is we don't want to see folks buy units and keep them empty. That doesn't add to the supply at all. And New York has that issue. Now, I was surprised to read about Millennium Tower. So I think it's something that we're talking about. We started talking about it this week. What can we do to make sure that the units that are built are occupied? So we do want to analyze that issue because we know it's been an issue in other cities. The luxury housing is taking some pressure off downtown markets. Mm. And so glad to see it. And it's walk to work, and it's the right density in the right place. So pleased to see it. But the mayor's been very focused on making sure that we're building housing for our most needy and for our middle class. We don't want a city where we have lower income folks and rich folks and no middle class. We wouldn't have a healthy city. So we are starting to see a shift from developers building luxury downtown housing to housing in neighborhoods that is more affordable in the market. And that's a good trend.
Is the shift significant enough, though?
The shift is significant. More developers are seeing the benefit of developing more moderately priced housing in outside the core. And it's a very good shift.
Yeah.
And we've been working with developers too. We've been, asking them to do it. We've been making land available. We've been easing the permitting process. We're, working on some tax relief. So we've been doing a lot to encourage this.
Right. I'm curious what your take is on how we find the right balance, especially when it comes to neighborhood life, of building units that are for owner occupancy or for rental or, for investment. And the reason why I ask this is not that long ago, a woman who lives in Alston came up to me and she was very deeply concerned about, she's seeing all sorts of construction happen. And while she was glad for it, she was concerned that at least in her immediate vicinity, it was mostly for rental. And what she believes, and I think it's not an uncommon belief, that in order for a neighborhood to thrive, you need to have a lot of owner occupancy as well. And she just wasn't seeing, the city isn't supporting enough development for housing that will be owner occupied so that people are invested in the neighborhoods that they're living in.
I think she has a good point. We did see the last year and a half, the vast majority of permits pulled were for rental housing. We're now seeing more developers come forward, and I think it's the cost of construction and the numbers work better. We're seeing more homeownership projects come forward, which is great, which is really, really good. We do want people to come, put down roots, and buy housing. And we are looking at our home buying programs right now to see how to increase our down payment and closing cost assistance.
Well, that's on the ownership side, but is there anything the city can do? I mean, it's the city that's giving out the permits to encourage developers to build more owner occupancy housing.
It is being encouraged. It is hard, though, when we have a rental shortage as well,
right,
not to encourage rental housing. But I understand that. I think the mayor, too, has been very interested in looking at areas of the city that where we can build good, dense housing next to transit, but also preserving the character of our existing neighborhoods. We don't want to build so much housing in our existing neighborhoods that people don't recognize their neighborhoods anymore. So we need to build in a way that's very, very respectful of what we have. And it's hard to do, but I think we're doing a good job.
Well, Sheila Dillon is Chief of Housing and Director of the Department of Neighborhood Development for the City of Boston, checking in with us on this grand move-in day for so many thousands of people. Sheila Dillon, thanks so much for joining us again.
Sure, my pleasure, anytime.
Look forward to having you back.
Okay.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Our show is produced by Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Adam Asher. Tim Skoic is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. Mm-hmm.